What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. You have to see these things as expressions of God's will. You don't have to like it, of course.
The boss isn't always right, but he's always the boss.
That's right. Things aren't so bad. Look at the parking lot, Larry. Just look at that parking lot.
Just look at that parking lot. The junior rabbi there in the Coen Brothers, A Serious Man, painting a pretty good portrait of Hollywood's offerings in the first part of the new year. Legends of Hercules, anyone? Which is why on this show, we do a bit of looking behind and a bit of looking ahead. The Film Spotting Top 5 this week, our most anticipated movies of 2014.
We've also staged a movie deathmatch between two newly minted Oscar nominees, The Wolf of Wall Street versus American Hustle. Here, Adam, defend the wrong one and more.
I'm sorry, what? I was just putting on my toupee there.
Need a little more hairspray there, I think. Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM1. Listening to Film Spotting. With the Oscars still more than a month away, it'll be a while before the 2013 movie year gets completely out of the way for 2014, but we'll give you plenty of good reasons to look ahead with our top five most anticipated movies of the new year later in the show. We're also going to share some thoughts on last week's Oscar nominations, where I'll resist the urge to drunkenly heckle Philomena for its Best Picture nomination when a certain Coen Brothers masterpiece, Josh, failed to get a nod.
Leave Dame Judi Dench alone, Adam.
I think she can handle me.
She probably could. Let's start, though, with the showdown between two other Best Pick nominees, American Hustle and The Wolf of Wall Street.
Can you say that again? Just the way you said it. Just the same way.
I don't know what you're talking
about. Oh, come on. You know what I'm talking about. Just say the same thing. I think what Jordan just did is he... If I'm not mistaken, you just tried to bribe a federal officer.
No, technically I didn't bribe anybody.
No, technically, that's not the conversation.
No. According to the U.S. Criminal Code, there needs to be an exact dollar figure for an exchange of services that would not hold up in a court of law.
I heard it.
No. That's the truth. But I want to tell you this.
Yeah.
The same gentleman that told me that you tried to get your broker's license also told me that you were a straight arrow.
You ran a security check on me.
Well, now when you... sail on a boat fit for a Bond villain, sometimes you need to play the part, right?
That was Leonardo DiCaprio as Jordan Belfort and Kyle Chandler as Agent Patrick Denham in The Wolf of Wall Street. Martin Scorsese's black comedy based on Belfort's memoir about being a sketchy penny stock empire builder and the decadent lifestyle that enabled him to live. We're going to put Scorsese's dark take on the American dream against David O. Russell's American Hustle. That film stars Christian Bale, Amy Adams, Bradley Cooper, and Jennifer Lawrence's various cops and grifters in late 70s New Jersey. It's also based on actual figures and events. We should maybe begin, Adam, by acknowledging that neither of us really agrees with this sort of format. We don't have to choose between these two films. But we're going to make an exception for this case for a couple of reasons. These are big films that we didn't get a chance to give full reviews to on the show. Both have been recently nominated for multiple Oscars, including Best Picture, and there are some thematic similarities here. Shady characters shortcutting their way to the American dream. There's also this irresistible hook. We're on the opposite sides of this false choice we're giving listeners.
Yeah, I think it's maybe more of a showdown between us, potentially, than these films.
That's a good way to put it. I did have American Hustle as my number 16 film of 2013. Wolf of Wall Street, that's your number 11. Let's start with The Wolf of Wall Street, since we already did it earlier this week with an exchange on Letterboxd. You can find Adam there as Film Spotting, and I'm on there as Larson on Film. We both had reviews up, and some interesting comment threads on both sides came about. I looked at your notes, and it's not a full review you gave, a full written review, but you jotted a couple notes there. And you talked mostly about what The Wolf of Wall Street is not. You said it's not a cautionary tale, as Belfort mainly gets away with it. You also said it's not a glorification of this debauched lifestyle that Belfort and his protégés live. I'd agree with both of those sentiments, actually, but that does still leave us with a question. What is The Wolf of Wall Street? And once we've defined that, because I think we're going to actually probably agree on that definition too, but then maybe we can explore how does it use this particular identity to be, as you called it on Letterboxd, great.
Well, I guess I would start by asking, why does it have to be anything, at least anything that we can sum up in a single word or phrase? I do get the compulsion by audiences and perhaps critics to do that, to try to put the
it's
movie...
kind of our job, isn't it?
Maybe, but not necessarily to put it in a neat little box, but with a movie like this where I could see people, again, whether audience members or film critics, having just spent 3 hours with these pretty repugnant characters, maybe they want to try to understand why Scorsese would feel compelled to make us spend 3 hours with those people, why it would all be worth it. But it's to Scorsese's credit and to our benefit, ultimately, that The Wolf of Wall Street defies such easy categorization. That said, if you're going to force me into some kind of definition, this isn't nuclear physics here. The movie's exactly what it is. It's the story of one man's reinvention, his rise to fortune and relative fame through unscrupulous manipulation of the American financial system, which also happens to serve as a microcosm for American capitalism as a whole and the pursuit of the so-called American dream, a dream fueled as we see it here and in other films by avarice, by debauchery, as you mentioned, by self-delusion. It's really no different than exactly what we see in Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, only instead of wistful pining for a former love and lost innocence, we get hookers and blow and 170-foot yachts. We've come a long way, baby, since Fitzgerald. Why is it great? I would say, Josh, for the same reasons we all consider Gatsby the novel to be great. It's a fascinating tale of an enigmatic character that also explores and reflects something significant about human nature and the world we live in. The recent past, let's just go back to 2008 and our recent economic downturn, the present, and surely, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, our future. Then you add in the formal elements. DiCaprio's titanic performance, and no, there was no pun intended, but I'll go ahead and roll with it. Everything about the way music is used and voiceover is used, the Brechtian breaking the fourth wall elements of the movie, Rodrigo Prieto's provocative camera work, Thelma Schoonmaker's dynamic editing, all of these things we've come to identify with Scorsese and, I suppose, call cinema. Unlike, Josh, the vast majority of everything we both saw this year, The Wolf of Wall Street, I would venture to say, is going to be dissected and debated for decades because it captures a specific period and place, but is also timeless in the themes it explores. And considering all of that I've just said, I would throw back to you the more appropriate question is really, how can it be anything but great?
Well, I'll give you one reason. Let's start with your description of Belfort as an enigmatic character. Gatsby certainly is. Belfort is an exceedingly thin character. That's one of the ways this film falls very short in my mind. And you could say it's not supposed to be a character study, except that was one of the defenses you just gave. I've seen people say that. This is just about what this guy did. This is about his actions. And I would agree this movie
wouldn't
is
call it
obsessed
a character study.
With the behavior of its characters.
Sure.
It gives us nothing in terms of their psychology, in terms of what drives them to act this particular way, what's behind their choices that they've made.
They're human.
And
they're
okay,
human and they're
you.
Americans.
Yes, I realize they're human and they're Americans, but a 3-hour film, I would like to explore it a little more deeply than that, which something like The Great Gatsby gives. We don't get any sense of what is driving, any sense of the psychology, not only of Belfort, but let's look of this entire financial realm that they're involved in. Why is it a group mentality? What is actually being sought in this avid pursuit of sex and drugs? We get it that it's sex and drugs because we get a lot of that. But where's the exploration of why does the mentality tend toward that way in this particular setting? We don't really get any of that. We just get repeated
scenes
of it.
You wanted a sociology experiment.
I didn't want a sociology experiment. I wanted a film that was partly curious about the behavior, not just showing the behavior. And DiCaprio is also not enigmatic because he's not very funny here. He is just not a comedic actor. And this is a black comedy and it is a satire. And you've hooked it on someone who has great dramatic talent. I really do respect DiCaprio as a dramatic actor. And I think he has comic potential, but it is not shown off in this movie at all. And that's what the movie needs. And this ties to another thing you're talking about, the formal elements of the movie that wowed you. it did not wow me in terms. It did some of those tricks you were talking about with the point of view and him breaking the fourth wall. And that's nothing inventive to the movies at all, let alone Scorsese. So I understand that it's doing it, but just because it's doing it does not wow me. And DiCaprio does not bring that level of humor or comedic performance. As a matter of fact, this whole cast is surprisingly dull for what should be a black comedy. Jonah Hill gets a few laughs, but he's mainly in a dramatic part. He is a comedian. He can make some of those work. Rob Reiner gets one funny scene. Otherwise, all of his scenes that are supposed to be comic fall flat, again, because of the psychology. He plays Belfort's father, and we don't understand who he's supposed to be. At one point, he's just a raging lunatic, and then they hire him as security. In one scene, he's criticizing them for spending money, and then the exact next scene, he's sitting back and joking with DiCaprio's character about how he spent the money on the women. So there's no consistency there. And there's one scene I want to talk about that falls flat that I think is representative of how the comedy doesn't work, and it's where Belfort and his colleagues are discussing what they're going to do with the little people that they hired.
I love it. This is one of my key scenes, too.
It's a key scene because it completely fails. It goes on so long, and everyone at that table is searching for a joke that will be an un-PC joke that's going to get us to laugh in the audience, to also see that they're really despicable guys. All the things that the movie is trying to do should be happening at that scene, and it doesn't work because these aren't funny actors at work here. I would have liked to have seen that scene with the group from This Is the End, people like Seth Rogen and his co-writer and director, Evan Goldberg. You give people who know broad comedy and decidedly un-PC comedy and let them at that scene, and it would have sung.
$430,000 in 1 month, Jordy? Huh?
They're business expenses. Yes.
Jordy, look what you got here.
What?
Look at this. $26,000 for one dinner.
No. This could be explained. Dad, we had Pfizer clients.
Right. The porterhouse from Argentina.
The expensive champagne and the wine. We had to buy champagne. And you ordered all the sides. Tell them about the sides.
I ordered the sides. So
sides? Yeah. Sides? $26,000 worth of sides? What are these sides? They cure cancer?
The sides did cure cancer. That's the problem. That's why they were expensive.
Shut up.
I'm serious. I know.
Stop.
Yeah, it's just interesting, though, because when you talk about it this way, and we talk about the whole film this way, as if it's supposed to be a laugh fest, I don't think on any level it's going for that, despite the fact that it clearly has darkly comic moments, and that a scene like
this
the one...
This is a comedy, Adam.
I completely disagree with the notion that this is a comedy. No, it's not. That doesn't mean there aren't funny moments. Of course there are, and that there aren't scenes where Scorsese is specifically trying to provoke laughter, but I'm not watching that scene expecting punchlines of any kind, nor did I get any. And that
did you
was
notice the dead
fine.
Air in it, though?
No,
there's
I didn't.
Dead air
I didn't.
In that
well,
scene.
Well, I wouldn't call it dead air, but we have a completely different read on that scene, and I'll get to that in a second. I'll say this because we have one small bit of common ground. The most blatantly comedic moments in the movie, the ones where Scorsese was clearly trying to go for humor that don't work at all, are all the scenes with Rob Reiner. That said, I'm not going to dwell on it too much. He probably has 4 minutes of screen time. Truly, he does not take away from this movie for me in any way. That said, his character could have been completely cut out, and I would have been just fine with it. But let's talk about that scene, because that was a key one for me, Josh, where as I was watching The Wolf of Wall Street for the first time, some of these scenes were playing a little bit flat for me. And we got to this scene in particular where what's happening is they are sitting around the four or five main guys of this company that Jordan Belfort has started, Stratton Oakmont, and they're spending a lot of time drawing up the contract and debating what they can and can't do with these little people. I mean, I think they call them midgets in the scene. It's like it's midget tossing, basically, is what they're doing. They're going to have a party to celebrate the end of the week, and they're going into a lot of detail about what they're going to do at this party with these little people. And as I was watching it, I was thinking, when did Martin Scorsese turn into Judd Apatow? Because that sense of scene sort of playing out for a while and being a little bit shaggy and characters just kind of riffing without it going anywhere. And also the presence of Jonah Hill, maybe that somehow clicked in my brain a little bit. And I was thinking, come on, do we really need 5, 6, 7 minutes of this? I'd get the point after 2 or 3 minutes. And then it occurred to me, Josh, as I was thinking this, as I'm sitting there in the theater thinking, wow, this is indulgent, it occurred to me, of course it feels a little bit unnecessarily indulgent. That's exactly the point. How better to understand just how excessive and vulgar the behavior of these characters is than to allow or force, depending on how you look at it, the audience to experience it with them. You want to understand the psychology of these degenerates, as Jordan calls himself throughout this movie? Force the audience to go through experiences like this with them. And it really crystallized for me, not only with that scene, Josh, but a little bit later, the Quaalude scene with the lemons, where Jonah Hill, this is really a tour de force scene, I'm sorry, where they've taken some Quaaludes that are old and they kick in very late. But when they finally kick in, they really pack a punch. And Scorsese shows us every single step of this experience as he drags himself out the door of this country club, down the steps, into his car. And the whole point, Josh, is that indulgence, that excessiveness. These scenes don't go on too long because suddenly, somehow, Martin Scorsese and Thelma Schoonmaker forgot how to pace the scene. It was clearly by design to have the content and form match. It's as if Scorsese was
saying, I have a problem with the design.
I completely understand
what you're saying.
You think Jordan's lifestyle was excessive, he's going to show you excessive. And that, Josh, for me, is my big point on this, because if you want to talk about whether there is satire here at all, whether there's commentary, whether there's any judgment on Scorsese's part, it's in that excessiveness. A movie that really wanted to glorify Jordan Belfort's behavior is one that would have cut those scenes down into tidy, digestible packages that would have gave us laughs and sent us on our way and done nothing to challenge us. Scorsese challenges us by making those scenes excessive and indulgent.
You know what would have been more challenging for the audience? To have shown that those guys could be funny. That would have been
what
really
does that
challenging.
Show? They're not
we
comedians.
We know they're decadent and debauched from the very beginning. We don't need to have repeated scenes. It's the excessiveness is redundant. It's like a satirist. This isn't a sharply aimed arrow that's shot and hits the bullseye. This is someone walking up to the bullseye, jamming the arrow right in the target, and then twisting it for 3 hours. We get that they're debauched. I understand that. What would have been a bigger challenge is to see that these guys can be funny. Here's what's possibly attractive about hanging out with this group. That's more of a dilemma for the audience. So then you see that they're actual people, not these cartoon villains.
Funny isn't
that this
important.
Movie
funny
sets
is
funny
so
is
not
very important.
Important
to
no,
see
it's
what's
not
charming about their
There's
lifestyle.
There's plenty of charm to DiCaprio's
character. And let's get to American,
character.
Not at all.
I a
mean,
lot.
The movie repeatedly emphasize what a scuzzbag he is, and there's something smug about
and alluring,
that. There's
very alluring
not allowing him to be a human at all. And I think this is where we can jump to American Hustle.
Please
because
don't.
These guys are complete cardboard villains that Scorsese sets up for us to laugh at the audience if we get it, and then we can be smug because we get it and the audience is really forced to eat it. I don't know who this audience is that's
eating it. I don't know why you feel so put
it.
Upon by this film.
Because it's a very smug attitude towards its characters that doesn't even allow them to be human. Yes, I'm defending Jordan Belfort here because I would like to have seen
you
a
should.
Portrait
He's
of
human.
Him. This movie doesn't
And the
show
movie shows
that.
Him that way.
Let's talk about American Hustle. This is a movie that takes much more time to explore of its main characters. I get such a better idea of why these people are hustling, why they're taking advantage of others. It's not quite as obsessed with their decadent lifestyle, but we get some hints of that. You totally understand. The big revelation in American Hustle when Christian Bale, who's the main character, and he plays this guy who's hustled pretty much since he's been a kid, and he saw his dad getting ripped off. That's been part of his motivation. So now this is how he's going to get his part of the American dream. We spend about maybe a half hour, I'm not sure, learning the ropes with this guy and how he's screwing people, similarly to the way Belfort does. He's on a much smaller scale, but just as a despicable of a character in terms of what he's doing to people in terms of finances. Then we get this sudden reveal that he's a dad who's adopted this kid from a woman he kind of married just to do the right thing. He's adopted her kid, and we get this whole other side of him. And that just enriched the experience. And you go on to Jennifer Lawrence, who is the woman, and you get a little bit of shading of what she is doing with these people and how she cons them. You get Amy Adams' character, which is completely richer than anyone in The Wolf of Wall Street, yet it's exploring the same things, why these people are taking advantage of others. And they're much more complicated, much more wrestling that the audience has to do with those characters than anyone in The Wolf of Wall Street, who we can just see are despicable and laugh at them. And that's all we get. That is all
think,
we get. It is
I don't
so
think they're just
thin
despicable.
As a satire.
I don't think they're just despicable. I also don't think it is, there you go, putting in that box again, as a satire. I don't think that is Scorsese's objective at all. And I do think that anyone who watches Jordan Belfort in this movie and his Merry Men, and they only judge him, and they only sit there and think, I'm such a much better person than this scumbag. First of all, congratulations, your nomination for sainthood is in, but you're also delusional and as egomaniacal as Jordan Belfort is, because there is something alluring about
his behavior. I didn't say
that's
what I was thinking when I was watching the
movie. I know, but I'm speaking to some of the critics of this film. I do think the big point here, Josh, about the psychology and the big problem I have with you focusing so much on funny is because it's truly, and don't jump in here and tell me how it's the nature of film criticism. I get it. I'm still going to say it. What you're focusing on is the most subjective thing in the world, what makes somebody
laugh.
Funny
reveals character.
It's what makes someone laugh. And here's the problem, Josh. Your whole take on The Wolf of Wall Street is predicated on the fact that you didn't laugh. But guess what? I saw it in two theaters full of people who laughed at the midget tossing scene. So are they just not as refined as you? Or what's the
You'd
deal?
You'd have to talk to them about the film.
Or could it in fact be funny and be more than what you're giving it credit for? So that's your reaction.
There
that's
could
great.
Be people who
but
are laughing
very
at this
subjective
film because
reaction.
They think these guys are awesome. There's also the target audience here.
And that's
who is
great,
gonna
too.
See the, it's
you know
the
what?
Wall Street crowd
but that's
who's
great, too,
see
Josh,
it as,
that we can all watch that film and have
right, so
that different of an experience.
So it doesn't, it doesn't invalidate my interpretation.
No,
there are other people who have a different one and are laughing for different reasons than you laugh.
Right,
does that invalidate your
here's the
sense
difference.
Of humor for the film?
Well, I wasn't cracking up throughout the movie, but I also wasn't expecting laughs or thinking that Scorsese was trying
so
to get laughs.
So now you're laughing and you're not laughing. I mean,
no, I didn't say I was laughing. I said I saw it in a packed theater where people were laughing, and I did laugh at scenes, but I was not watching scenes like the one with the little people going, gosh, where's the punchlines, and thank God I got them, and I laughed seven times. No, I wasn't counting.
It's
I
a matter
wasn't
of
thinking
structure
about that
in
way.
That scene.
And I think the structure, as I said, is all about the indulgence and pushing it past the point of no return. That's the whole film. That's these characters. The big difference, if you are going to force me to talk about American Hustle, a movie I think is fine. It's a well-made movie. There's some impeccable exuberance, to use Michael Phillips' phrase. It's the absolutely right word to describe some of the filmmaking in American Hustle. But it's not a film that is going to provoke the type of discussion we're already having and the type of vitriol that we're having about a movie like The Wolf of Wall Street. I just don't think I just don't think it has any meat to it beyond it being an enjoyable sort of romp where we get some people with some goofy haircuts and they act a little silly. And then at the end of the movie, it decides we're going to cap on this con man caper and make it all pay off. That's fine, but it doesn't give us anything to really debate, and The Wolf of Wall Street certainly does.
The funny thing is, I would have agreed with you completely on that after first seeing American Hustle, as much as I liked it. It wasn't until seeing The Wolf of Wall Street again when I realized there was a lot more there in terms of exploring what's behind the mindset of someone who hustles like this and takes advantage of people. It took The Wolf of Wall Street for me to appreciate American Hustle.
I just think then that is a valid point, except for the fact that I'm not watching The Wolf of Wall Street looking for psychology, and I'm so grateful to Martin Scorsese for not trying to explain it. You know why? Mainly because he doesn't have to. Jordan Belfort exists, has existed, and will exist for all time because there are people like us in the world who want to be people like them. We hold on to this myth that the American dream is out there for all of us to achieve. It's tantalizing. You see it in so many scenes. And we are always going to have characters like him there to take advantage of other people in the world. That's honesty. The fact that Scorsese depicts it that way without trying to come up with any kind of psychological explanation is really the only truthful way he could have come at this story. And I know that I really have not actually read many takes on this at all. I think the only one I've read is Richard Brody in The New Yorker. But I know from seeing Letterboxd and a few other places that people have an issue with the fact that there really aren't any consequences for his actions, that we don't really see the victims of any of his crimes. And that's true. But the reality is, Josh, that there aren't consequences in judgment for all of the bad guys on Wall Street. These people don't suffer consequences, and moreover, they aren't worried about consequences, which is really the key point. Whose story is this? Right from the beginning, who's telling this story? Who's our unreliable narrator? It's Jordan Belfort. He definitely isn't thinking about the consequences of his actions, the victims he's leaving in his wake. As he says at one point, echoing a line straight out of Henry Hill and Goodfellas, he even says, I know how to spend their money better than they do. That's what he believes. So to shoehorn in consequences, to shoehorn in those victims would have been completely disingenuous. And wisely, Scorsese does just show us behavior and shows us their actions and lets us decide what we think the psychology is. Let's us decide what's alluring, what isn't alluring, what we reject, what we don't reject. He lets the audience think for itself. I applaud him for that.
Yeah, and I'm not arguing at all that he should have had consequences. I mean, if it wanted to reflect the real world, that should certainly be a part of that. Mm-hmm. So that's the honor of having a more truthful rather than a Hollywood ending.
Right.
And The Wolf of Wall Street certainly doesn't have that. You could argue that's a weakness of American Hustle in that it does find a way to get a fairly happy ending for these con men. And it definitely falters a little bit at the end. It makes me think of Silver Linings Playbook, David O. Russell's previous film, which I don't think you cared for.
I did not.
Very much. Didn't that have a somewhat similar ending where things kind of turned to make that Hollywood twist happy ending? I haven't revisited it since last year, but I seem to recall that. And it is the mark of a filmmaker who's willing and able to not go for that crowd-pleasing twist at the end. It's interesting that Russell certainly didn't at the beginning of his career, but he seems to have headed a little bit in that direction now.
You're going to do this because you got no choice. You work for me.
You keep changing the rules. You know, you're getting a little power drunk, Richard. You know, you want to tell him anything? You want to wake him up?
Oh, no. I said we shouldn't do any of it, Irving. You know I said that. So now I support Richie. He's got vision. Do it heavy or don't do it.
What does that mean? I mean, he's the one ruining America, not me.
How the f*** am I ruining America?
Because people just got over Watergate and Vietnam, all right? And you're going to shit all over politicians again? It's just because you want to be a big shot, get a promotion.
No. I'm thinking big. All right, this is going to be fantastic. We're doing video surveillance. I'm doing this from the feet up.
You will never do it properly because you got too much government attitude to be small and sleek. I'm like the Viet Cong, man, all right? I'm in and I'm out. I was there the whole time. You don't know it, all right? That's an art of becoming somebody who people can pin their beliefs and their dreams on.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're debating the merits of The Wolf of Wall Street versus American Hustle, two movies that were recently nominated for Best Picture and are out now in wide release. It's interesting that you focus on the ending, unfortunately, because we're not really going to get into spoiler territory, though I'm not sure there's much of a spoiler to the ending of The Wolf of Wall Street. That's one of the key scenes for me. As I mentioned on our live show last week, one of my favorite scenes in all of cinema this year is the closing shot and those final minutes of The Wolf of Wall Street. And I don't think we're going to be able to get into it here, but maybe we can save it for some bonus content to get into that a little bit more. I did want to say one of the things I loved about this movie, as we talk about some of those formal elements that did excite me as I watched this movie, I do love that there's a lot of camera movement. There's a lot of quickness to the cuts. It is sort of that Martin Scorsese style we've seen in a lot of movies, where it's very active, but at the same time, he really knows when to slow a scene down when he's giving us a scene that is the crux of the whole film or a very important one in the development of the characters. You talk about your desire to hear more psychology. I think we get it in the scene with Matthew McConaughey, where he meets his first mentor, his first day on the job on
Wall
Street.
Really good scene.
Great scene. McConaughey's amazing in it. And he sits down and he explains to him this lifestyle and what it's all about. And that moment is the hook. That's what grabs DiCaprio's character, Jordan Belfort, and carries him throughout all of his actions. All that we see unfold throughout the rest of the movie is laid out in that sequence. And one of the key things that is set up there in that sequence is what McConaughey tells him about how it's all an illusion. Everything that he's going to deal with on Wall Street is an illusion. It's a fantasy. Money isn't real. It's all on paper that this wealth exists. And his job is just to keep that circulating and keep himself wealthy while taking advantage of his clients. So what Scorsese does throughout the movie is he plays with that. He plays with that sense of artifice and that sense of self-delusion by, for one, referencing a lot of other movies, just in terms sometimes of style, but also what the characters say, which I think lends overall to this performance aspect of the film. DiCaprio, I know his performance didn't do much for you, but watching him in a key scene in that movie go through the mental process of standing up in front of his staff and saying, "I'm walking away," and then convince himself not to. That is a performance within a performance, and another amazing scene in this movie. He's constantly performing.
I'm glad you brought up
that scene. These characters are all performing.
He's really good there, and it's because it depends on that note of deception that DiCaprio has to all of his best characters, I think. And it's also a key scene for me because he talks a little bit to one of his employees directly in front of everyone and talks about how he first hired her.
Kimmy.
And how it was this this act of altruism is how he depicts it, in that he gave her a shot to pay her bills by taking on this job, learning the ropes with him, and she's become, they tick off all the things she owns now.
Mm-hmm.
And that really worked for me because we got a little bit of the wrestling there of how this has been a warped version of the American dream and how the hoisting yourself up by your bootstraps right. mentality is still used. The language of that is still used, even though what you're really doing is hoisting yourself up while you're stomping on other people below you.
Yeah.
And I'll give you credit for that scene where it starts to explore those things and let us get a sense of the background of some of these characters and how they've made these decisions mm-hmm. and rationalize some of these things, Kimmy particularly. And I wish there had been more of that in the movie. Where you see some of that in that scene with McConaughey. Where did that Belfort go? Where he was trying to figure it out and he's trying to make choices. After that scene, we jump ahead and we get pretty much the monster that
he
we see for the rest
choice.
Of the film
he made
over,
his
and
there.
Over and over
right.
and over.
We do.
And
it's about repetition and ritual, and
okay,
the whole
so
movie's about that.
You greatly appreciate the repetition
I
of
do.
This film, which I found tedious and punishing.
Exactly.
And I want to get to that ending shot. I won't give it away because I don't have to. You've talked about how brilliant the ending shot is mm-hmm. of this film. Didn't we already get it? And this isn't what happens in the ending shot, so I'm not getting anything away. But maybe about 45 minutes in, Belfort has started his own company, but it's out of a garage. And he's training these goofballs who will end up getting rich along with him through the rest of the film. But he's training them at the very beginning how to hook somebody mm-hmm. on a really bad stock sale.
Yeah.
And so he places this call, and it's an extended scene where DiCaprio, he's got some good moments, good comic moments here. I'll give you that. He's talking to the guy while pulling faces to his friends about what a rube this guy is.
Right.
We get that's the same scene we
completely
get at the
different
end.
Scene.
The same
no.
thing is being said
some
there.
Of the circumstances
so
are the same.
Sense,
a lot are different.
The whole thing about we're going to swallow this and we're going to take it and we're just going to accept it. Why don't we stop these guys? This is what the American people want. They want to believe these things. All that said, which I think is fairly interesting and fairly timely, it's said there early on in the film. And we get it then. So it's not a stroke of brilliance to repeat it in a slightly different way at the end of the film. Everything is repeated over and over. And I just did not get much from the redundancy.
I reject your reading of the end scene. I think there's a lot more going on. There are some layers there and some nuance that you're missing. Unfortunately, I'm not going to get into it here. We'll have to talk about it in bonus content, Josh, because I want to get into the specifics of the final shot and those final couple minutes. I think there's something you're overlooking there, potentially. You're not going to agree with me, but I do think there's something you're missing. And I just want to close by going back to some of those elements in terms of that fantasy element and the way Scorsese includes some of that artifice, because it really is about performance. It really is about these characters completely reinventing themselves. That's what makes the American dream different from other dreams, is you can't do this elsewhere where you can't escape your upbringing and your family background. Here in America, what we see is you can invent a character. And that's who Jordan Belfort is. He is a character that is not only invented by Leonardo DiCaprio, but invented by Jordan Belfort. He is the Wolf of Wall Street. And we see the way Scorsese plays with that in a lot of regards. You talk about the self-made man, that conversation that we opened with Kyle Chandler and DiCaprio on his yacht. He says that to him. He basically says, you got to be a douchebag all on your own. Most people, they have to learn it. There has to be some element in your background that makes you this way. Getting to your point about psychology, no, there's not. He's the ultimate self-made American. He made himself this character. And that's the beauty of the American dream and also the tragedy of the American dream in a lot of ways. And I just think that there's so many interesting things that Scorsese is doing with the camera and the editing to play with that, beyond just the fact that on a pure technical level, Scorsese's always been one of these filmmakers who does not pay much attention to continuity. You can go back and look at a lot of Scorsese's films where people are having a conversation and those things that someone might look at and see, oh, that's a continuity error. Their hand is in a different place. They had a cigar in their hand. Now it's not there. In this film, he and Shoemaker really take it to another level where there are constantly little continuity, quote unquote, errors. But what I noticed the second time I saw this movie is every time the camera cuts on one of those abrupt errors, it's right on a crucial beat. It's always right on something Scorsese is trying to direct our attention to or get us to focus in on. It's a key moment every single time. There's a real momentum to the way all of these scenes are cut together because of that technique. And I think that that obviously speaks to Scorsese's brilliance and the collaborators he's working with here, Josh. So, you know, the subject matter, you found it redundant. You found it tedious. maybe that made it harder to really be wowed by some of those moments. But I could go back and just watch select sequences from this film all the time, over and over again, because I think that it's not just about the camera doing something interesting. It's about how the camera and the editing are combining together, and sometimes the music and voiceover, to really make us think about something, and sometimes to challenge us on something, to really make us see the allure of what's going on, because you do have to accept that there is something alluring about some of the behavior we see, as repugnant as it mostly is.
Let me get back to your thought about reinventing themselves, because it gives me another chance to talk about American Hustle. And one reason I wrote the movie off before I had even seen it is because of all the costumes,
right,
and the hairstyles. And I really thought, especially seeing Christian Bale, who I sometimes have a problem with working so loudly on the outside, I thought, oh boy, here we go again. But that is crucial in American Hustle, how they reinvent themselves through their various looks. And we joked about the opening scene where Bale is meticulously putting his toupee on together. And I think Russell, speaking of letting scenes play out, as you've talked about with The Wolf of Wall Street, Russell does something very interesting there in that he lets that scene play out way past the laughter. After we laugh at the look and after we laugh at how meticulous he's being, he lets us sit there with it and realize what it means to this guy, why he gives this so much attention. And all that's doing is building a ton of character and psychology in a wordless opening scene in a really brilliant way.
But it also speaks to one of the things I didn't appreciate about American Hustle, is this whole concept of the reality versus fantasy and the illusion and how that fits into the American dream and the sense of performance. All those things come through without Scorsese ever really having to articulate it. A character never really has to express it. It's there in the behavior and in those technical elements. In American Hustle, there comes a point about halfway through where this concept comes up. Characters start repeating it to each other, how it's all a fantasy. It's all illusion. I want to say, Josh, in that screenplay, there's got to be at least five times where a character underlines that theme.
There's a repeated line in the film, something about from the something up, from the feet up, or something like that, that they do repeat. And yeah, it does get a little repetitive that way, I'd agree.
Well, obviously, we do split quite a bit on The Wolf of Wall Street. American Hustle is a film I wish we could talk about in a little bit more detail. I'll just confess, as you know, Josh, I had planned to rewatch it before sitting down here with you and didn't have my screener. And I haven't seen this movie for 5 weeks. So unlike you, who I think you did get a chance to rewatch it recently.
A couple weeks ago, yeah.
You wrote a review of it as well, right?
Yep.
On your website.
Yeah.
So you've wrestled with it more. Maybe I'd have a different reaction if I did see that one again. But The Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle are both out now in wide release. If you get a chance to see them and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
We'll keep the Oscar talk going next with a film spotting poll asking you which Academy Award oversight you'd like to correct. Adam and I will also share our reactions to the nominations, and I actually have at least one positive comment. Stay with us.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch, a spider's touch, such a cold finger. His web of sin, but don't go in. Golden words he'll pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you fear. For a golden girl, know when he kissed her, it's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Beware of his heart of gold. This heart is cold.
Brief interruption here, everyone. We want to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM1.
Our featured listener site this week comes to us from Brandon Kahn. He writes, I've been listening to Film Spotting since Sam was a co-host and have used your podcast to power through a whole lot of commuting ever since. One of these days, I'll have a load of extra cash sitting around and we'll donate to say thanks. But until then, I thought I'd help with a Squarespace testimonial. I heard about Squarespace on your show back when they first became a sponsor. Years later, when it was time to put my next project online, I went there first, based largely on the testimonials from Film Spotting Nation. I shopped around a bit, and while the competition is stiff, Squarespace came out on top. For me, it came down to their classy templates, flexible customization options, and excellent support.
Brandon continues, after trying out their 14-day free trial, my site was already about 90% done, looking like someone who knew what they were doing was involved, complete with perfect social media integration and a responsive design that looks great on any device. After a bit of experimenting, I was able to adjust the template to make a unique, professional-looking site that fit the look and feel of the project, which I guess isn't impressive to a lot of people, but I was pretty blown away with how little time it took a web neophyte like me to go from zero to a good website. Thanks for the great podcast and for pointing me towards Squarespace. And the URL for Brandon's site is streetsofmyth.com if you want to check it out.
Yeah, and I did just check it out, Josh, as we were talking. Very nice-looking Squarespace website. Thank you, Brandon, for that great testimonial and those kind words. Some of the other features Brandon probably enjoys about Squarespace: the new Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad that allows you to check site stats like page views, unique visitors, and social media follows, and the fact that their platform started just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And social media was mentioned in there. They've got connected accounts, so you can connect Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google, whatever it is, and many more web and social services all through your Squarespace site. They also have e-commerce platforms, so if you want to set up a shop and sell things, you can do that, and it just takes a few minutes.
You can start a trial just like Brandon did without even using a credit card. Just start building your website. If you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, though, make sure to use the offer code FILM1 to get 10% off, and you'll also show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. This heart is cold. He loves only gold. Only
gold. He loves only gold. He loves only gold. I got it.
You got Cincinnati?
Yeah, you want it?
Could I have it?
Should I bring it in?
Yeah.
Do you owe me something? You have to owe me something.
I wish. People need time, you know, get to know you, buy you as a solo act, even know you're a solo act. Cincinnati is not good.
That's it, right?
Yeah, this is it. God help.
Nobody knew us when we were a duo. It's not like me and Mike were ever a big act. It's not a big re-education for the public. Mel? Mel!
How you doing, kid?
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Jerry Grayson as Mel and Oscar Isaac as Llewyn Davis in The Coen Brothers. Inside Llewyn Davis, nominated for Best Sound Mixing at this year's Academy Awards. We'll talk Oscar oversights with this week's poll question a little bit later here in the segment. But right now it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, in front of the live audience at our rap party, and with the help of James from that audience, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Joel, did you get your SAT scores yesterday?
Yes.
Well, how'd you do?
597 math, 560 verbal.
If you wanted to, could you take them over again?
I guess so.
Great.
Joel, I want to show you something.
Honey, did you pack my mace?
It's in your cosmetic case. Joel, do you hear something odd? Something unpleasant?
No.
The preponderance of bass, perhaps?
No.
Is this the way I left the equalizer?
No.
No. This is not some toy for you and your friends. If you can't use it properly, you're not to use it at all. My house, my rules.
That was Tom Cruise as Joel Goodson and Nicholas Pryor as Joel's dad. Also had Janet Carroll as Joel's mom in Risky Business from 1983. The writer and director was Paul Brickman.
Jack in Arlington, Virginia, a.k.a. Film Spotting East, said it's got to be Risky Business. After Wolf of Wall Street, isn't it quaint to think that what passed for a night of white boys cutting loose in the early 80s was a romantic evening with just one hooker? No quaaludes, no dwarf tossing, no snorting of anything off of or out of anyone. We've come so far in 3 decades, Jack says.
So he's suggesting that Joel Goodson grows up to be Jordan Belfort, essentially.
He wants to be. He definitely wants
to be. I could see that. Tim from Bakersfield, California said, the obvious tie-in is that the movie is all about questioning the American dream and what it means for young people. Also, the movie was a breakout role for Tom Cruise, just like Your Massacre Theater was a breakout role for James. Final and possibly the clearest tie-in, the director of Risky Business was Paul Brickman. A clear reference to your guys' Golden Brick Award.
Wow, one of the biggest reaches ever. But, Tim, I give you points
for it.
It's
like a Marx Brothers joke.
Yeah. Seth Gross in Santa Monica, California, closes us out with our tie-ins. He says the connection is that it is a quintessential Chicago film. Well, quintessential suburban Chicago film. Film Spotting is, of course, the quintessential Chicago film review program.
Oh, there you go.
That's a bold statement. We will confess, we were not thinking about us as the quintessential Chicago film review program.
Hardly.
But we were thinking about us as a Chicago show performing a live show on the north side of Chicago. So there was definitely that connection. Thank you, Seth. And Tim also got the tie in there in terms of all that American dream talk. It not only fits in nicely with our discussion this week of Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle,
definitely,
but with that larger theme as a whole that we did reflect on our top 10 films of 2013, how that was something that came up over and over again in films like Spring Breakers and, man, what was that other one? Josh, let's just move on. You know what? I don't think we need to really bring it up again. If you want to hear that scene, which, as we said, we perform live at our 2013 rap party at Main Stage, you can hear it and hear our favorite performances of the year and scenes of the year with our friend from the Chicago Tribune, Michael Phillips. That show is at filmspotting.net, or you can get it via iTunes. Josh, we did get a fair number of entries this week. There are people, I'm guessing, about my age who, you know, remember this film from the early 80s, probably watching it when their parents weren't home and weren't paying attention, and they were sneaking that in. So why don't you reach into the hat?
It's a personal story you're sharing here?
Well, maybe. Reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner would be Dave Spalding from Johnston, Iowa.
Congratulations, Dave, a fellow Iowan, and I think Dave is a listener who has been with us since show one.
Wow.
He's just now on episode 474, winning Massacre Theater. Congratulations, Dave. Email feedback@filmspotting.net to claim your Film Spotting t-shirt.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. There are tie-ins. There are always tie-ins, but we're not going to give you any hints. I will say that I think this scene may go on as long as some of the scenes you found tedious in The Wolf of Wall Street, Josh.
Hopefully it won't be as tedious.
We might be here for about a half an hour, so
it might get a little breathy, too, just to warn you.
It's definitely going to get breathy, though. I haven't really heard you rehearse at this point. You're going to start it off. I'm going to give you the action. And thinking about this performance, it just occurs to me, there's another tie-in with this performance, your performance in particular, that fits something we're going to talk about later in this segment that
excellent.
I don't think we had talked about at all.
How about that?
So there's maybe a little bit of a hint if you're really paying close attention as we get through this scene and the rest of this segment. Are you ready?
Okay.
And action.
Do you think about me when we're not together?
All I do is think about you. When I'm not with you, I'm not alive. Listen, Miss M, you're the best thing that ever happened to me.
I can't do this anymore.
What?
I can't go home every night and have him try to touch me. And all the time I'm just thinking about you. About us. When I push him away, he has a temper.
What do you mean? Does he hurt you?
There are these women, you know, on the Sally Jesse Raphael show the other day. And they were all wearing disguises so that their husbands couldn't find them. And they were living in shelters. And I thought I could go live in one of them. If they'd let me bring Walter with me, I could go live in one of them.
No, listen to me.
I could live in one of those someplace in another state where no one even knows who I am.
No, look, couldn't you just get a divorce and then...
He would get the condo, and he'd get the car, and he'd take Walter from me. He'd take Walter!
Listen, I know you think I'm just a kid, but I could never do anything bad to you or ever hurt you. A guy that does something like that to someone like you doesn't deserve to live. That's the truth. He doesn't deserve to live.
Oh, I suppose you're right. He doesn't. Oh, I love this song.
And scene. Wow. So what film starred Marilyn Monroe and then at the end starred the Queen of England?
question.
How are we ever...
Very good question.
How are we ever going to pin that down?
Should we give them the title of the song as another clue, or that might be too obvious?
I think we can say it. Isn't it Sweet Home Alabama?
It is.
Yeah,
yes,
Sweet Home Alabama. There you go. If you know what film we just massacred, wow. Email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, January 27th.
That's how I always react when I hear Sweet Home Alabama, by the
way. I'm sure.
That came very easily. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is. That's a straw, you see. Watching. And my straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
Don't bully me, Daniel.
Poll question time, and a perfect transition there from Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Dano and Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood from 2007. It turns out in our film spotting Mr. Anderson deathmatch that we posed at our live show last weekend, PTA definitely ended up drinking Wes Anderson's milkshake.
Ouch.
Which, based on the live crowd response, I kind of thought would happen. We were looking ahead to our 2014 preview. Our most anticipated movies of the year, both Wes Anderson and Paul Thomas Anderson have films coming out. Wes Anderson's movie is Grand Budapest Hotel, I believe scheduled for a March release.
Yep.
Paul Thomas Anderson's movie is Inherent Vice, based on the Thomas Pynchon novel, and it doesn't currently have a set release date. I'm guessing later in the year, maybe another master-esque December
most
release,
likely,
maybe
yeah.
close to Christmas. So we pose the question to you simply, which one of those two films do you pick? You can only go see one. Which one is it? Josh, how did it come out?
I think this is exactly how we heard the applause, actually, at the live show. 62% volume for Inherent Vice compared to 38% for Grand Budapest Hotel.
So that's what Film Spotting Nation says. You do recall, Josh, that a week before the live show, Sam Van Halgren, our esteemed producer, threw out this question, and we were discussing whether or not it was going to be lopsided. I think we both thought it was probably going to be in favor mm-hmm. of Paul Thomas Anderson,
yeah.
even though you voted Wes and I voted PTA.
This would have been my guess.
Do you remember the percentages that I predicted?
It was close to this, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Oh, man.
That's how well I know my audience. 62-38. I called it. Almost 1,000
votes. You've got to monetize that skill somehow.
I guess so. I need to start predicting the future or something. Thank you to everyone who voted in that poll question and everyone who left a comment. We start with Max O'Connell, who often likes to weigh in on our poll questions. He starts, heavy sigh. My two favorite working directors. In any other year, Wes would take this. The Grand Budapest Hotel looks delightful, and the knowledge that he's playing with Academy ratio almost makes me give him the edge. But Paul Thomas Anderson is the filmmaker who I'll go to bat for every time. No director better understands terminal loneliness and alienation, or the deep desire to escape one's past, and there's no director who's his formal equal at this point. And he's adapting a great novel by Thomas Pynchon and bringing his master collaborator, Joaquin Phoenix, along. How could this not be my most awaited movie of the year? And he mentions Academy ratio there, studio film shot from the 30s through the 50s. Using that ratio, it looks more like a square, frankly, right? It's
yeah.
not the widescreen.
Well, we saw it in
it. Yeah.
Gus Van Sant's Elephant. He used it, Andre Arnold's Fish Tank, and really appreciated how it was used in
yep.
Kelly Reichardt's Meek's Cutoff.
It's a great effect there. That's not something I was thinking about at all in relation to my excitement for Grand Budapest Hotel, but now Max has me intrigued.
Jason Eakin from Los Angeles said, this question is almost unfair. I chose Paul Thomas Anderson, who should win in a landslide, but let me defend Wes Anderson for just a moment. Just because Wes Anderson's films all seem to exist in the same universe doesn't mean he isn't taking risks. In fact, it's a huge risk to do so, and he's doing it really well. Since The Life Aquatic, he seems to have kicked off a new phase in his filmmaking, where things not only feel like a dollhouse, but are also blatantly constructed pieces. He mentions the ship in Life Aquatic, the train at the end of the Darjeeling Limited, all of Fantastic Mr. Fox, and most of the climax of Moonrise Kingdom. Looking at that group of movies, Jason continues, there are obvious challenges he's set for himself, which is to his credit. But the fact that it negates a small part of the real-world lived-in-ness of Rushmore and the Royal Tenenbaums makes this a minor phase of his career. Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't have minor phases. He's on a whole other level, taking chances that seem positively out of left field until you see the film to see his uncanny handling of subjects and characters. A more difficult death match would have been P.T. Anderson versus Quentin Tarantino, who is in his own violent historical fantasies phase. Unfortunately, I think a lot of Film Spotting Nation would jump ship from P.T. to Q.T., and that would be a big mistake. Not that anyone actually has to make these sorts of decisions, of course.
Yeah.
Put your math skills to that. Adam. Mm. What would your prediction be?
I don't know.
For a QT versus PT?
Because that would really be the ultimate death match, for better or worse, for this audience. I think based on past history with poll questions and responses we've seen to Tarantino's movies over the years, I think that those two filmmakers right now, where they're at in their careers, the films they've made, I do think those two up against each other might be the closest director death match we could get.
Could you answer it right now?
I would go PTA. I think I would go PTA, and I actually do think PTA would ultimately win the poll question, but it would be very close. I'm going to say 54-46. What do you think?
All right. I'd still go West, so.
Of course you would.
No, I'd go PTA too.
I was going to ask you, Martin, if it would be possible not to use my real name when you write the story. Perhaps you could call me Nancy. I've always loved that name, Nancy. I have a niece called Nancy. Oh, no, maybe they think it's her. What about Anne? Anne Boleyn. That's a lovely name. Well, somebody had that.
We're going to have to use your real name, Philomena. That's the way these things work.
That was Steve Coogan as Martin Sixsmith and Judi Dench as Philomena in Philomena. It's one of the 9 films to be nominated for this year's Best Picture. Dench was also nominated for Best Actress, along with Coogan and co-writer Jeff Pope for Best Adapted Screenplay. We didn't give a lot of time to Philomena on the show. We did give a lot of time to Inside Llewyn Davis, which we should say wasn't entirely shut out by the Oscars. It was nominated for Cinematography by Bruno Delbonnel and Best Sound Mixing. All of that leads us to this week's poll. Speaking of snubs, if given the power, which 2014 Oscar oversight would you correct?
Yeah, we had many to choose from here. Yeah. We included for a while the leads from Her, the mm-hmm. Spike Jones film that we did both appreciate. My number 2 film of the year, Joaquin Phoenix, and also Scarlett Johansson. But I'm not sure either of those were as blatant or arguably as blatant as some of the other ones here on our list. Of course, you can share your comments in the poll if you do disagree with our options, but we gave you these choices: Tom Hanks for Best Actor in Captain Phillips, Inside Llewyn Davis for Best Picture, James Franco for Best Supporting Actor, Spring Breakers, James Gandolfini, Best Supporting Actor for Enough Said, Julia Louis-Dreyfus for Best Actress for Enough Said, or was it Oscar Isaac for Best Actor in Inside Llewyn Davis? So we're covering, you know, Enough Said, Inside Llewyn Davis, 2 movies that we both really liked, Spring Breakers, a movie we split on, and Captain Phillips, a film that we both appreciated. I think you a little bit more than me. We were both fans of Tom Hanks's performance. So of those, if you could correct one, you could change the Oscars, Josh, throw one of those into the mix, which one would it be?
Well, the shock for me here is Hanks. I mean, the Academy loves him, obviously, and those last 10 minutes may be the best performance minutes he's given in his mm-hmm. whole career. So I was really shocked by that. But the one I'd correct, the one I was really hoping she would get and would love to have seen her performance get this sort of attention, the film get this sort of attention, is Julia Louis-Dreyfus for Enough Said. And the whole film was pretty much ignored by the Academy, which is really a shame and a surprise, too, because it hit so many of those categories that the Academy loves. It mm-hmm. was, you know, for the most part, a feel-good movie. It resonated with audiences. It made decent box office, but no love from Oscar.
Yeah, I'm with you on the biggest surprise being Hanks. I really thought he was going to get a nomination for Captain Phillips, and he deserves it. It's not just a reputation thing. He's very good. I don't know if I had him in my final 5 or not on some of our film critic ballots, but I certainly had him in contention. The obvious answer for me is Inside Llewyn Davis. It was my number 1 film of the year. I love that movie, and I'm not totally shocked that it got overlooked for Best Picture. But of those 10 nominees, when you do look at some of the other films in the mix, especially a movie like Philomena, which you're right, we didn't talk about mainly because I just saw it. Didn't you just catch up with it fairly recently, Josh?
Yeah, I saw it, I think, the last week of the year, something like that. It's a good film.
Yeah, it's fine.
It hits a lot of those, checks a lot of those boxes for Oscar, too. So it's not an enormous shock that it's here.
Yeah, I just watched it a few nights ago, and that closed out all the nominees for Best Picture for me. And yeah, we agree, I think. I didn't read your take on it, but I saw your comments on Letterboxd, and it sounds like one of the things we both appreciated about it was the Steve Coogan character.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that it could have gone down a very traditional path with that character, where it really becomes a story about this character, this journalist, this cynical man somehow embracing the world and changing his whole perspective on life. And really, no, it's about the Judi Dench character and her trying to find the son that she was forced to give up many years before, back in Ireland when she became pregnant as a teen. And the Coogan character, sorry, spoiler alert, doesn't change all that much. And that's a good thing because it keeps the focus where it belongs in that movie.
And it's really remarkable the restraint he shows there in, because there are some scenes that go for comedy, but he doesn't, it's got to be hard when you're
right.
so funny to go for the jugular in comic scenes. And instead, he just kind of lays back and let the comedy come underneath. So I really did appreciate his performance in Philomena. And I do want to say the Inside Llewyn Davis snub, it's surprising, but when I look back on it, I think you can probably just point to the fact that it doesn't have a star in it. And for the most part, I know the Coen brothers have broken this rule before, the Academy needs some star to hang their Best Picture nomination on.
That's interesting. You might be right. And even though that is my obvious choice, anyone who's listened to our Top 10 Films of the Year show or listened to our live show or maybe attended it, you know that all those performers that were mentioned there are among my favorite of the year. I was hoping every single one of those options would have gotten a nomination. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. We already know what one listener thinks a little bit about the Oscar nominations, and this gives us a platform here for a few minutes, Josh, to reflect on those nominations. We got this email recently from listener Jeff, I'm going to say Sanguillo.
Oscar nominations were released this morning. In years past, I believe Film Spotting has been generally less than satisfied with their picks. However, I noticed that this year, of the 9 Best Picture nominations, 5 appear on the top 10 lists of Adam, Josh, Michael Phillips, or Scott Tobias. Many appear more than once. Oscar also showed love to The Act of Killing and The Wind Rises in their respective categories, 2 more movies that made appearances on your lists. Captain Phillips and Gravity also appeared on Josh's top 25 and Adam's top 19, respectively. That just leaves Dallas Buyers Club and Philomena. I believe Adam and Josh were divided on Dallas Buyers Club, and I don't remember hearing a review of Philomena. Considering all that, did Oscar get it right this year, or at least more right than usual?
What do you think, Josh?
Well, I think this is our chance to give some nice comments instead of complaining, which is our instinct to do after these nominations come out. And he's dead right about The Act of Killing. I mean, we suspected that it might get a documentary nomination, but really, I don't keep tabs on enough documentaries to know everything else that's out there that might be vying for those slots. So it was a relief to see that. And The Wind Rises, too. I mean, I'm in favor of animated films being able to compete for a Best Picture category, even though I know what that really means is they'll never win one. So I understand the thinking behind having this animation category. But for me, The Wind Rises was in my top 10 list, so it would have deserved, in my Oscar world, a nomination for Best Picture.
Yeah, I guess when I got Jeff's email, and he's absolutely right in terms of when he just recaps how these films ranked at the end of the year. If you look at those 9 films that were nominated for Best Picture, I only had one in my top 10, and that was Her. But 4 more I really liked, and 3 I liked enough. They're movies I recommend, including Dallas Buyers Club, not a movie I'm enthusiastic about, but I do think it's worth seeing. I throw Philomena in there as well. So of those 9 films, there isn't one I actively dislike or really feel strongly about dissuading anyone from trying to see. I think they're all pretty decent to great. And that is pretty rare. As I look back over the Best Picture nominees over the years, there are always one or two. In 2012, there were 4 movies nominated for Best Picture of the 9, so almost half that I really was not a fan of at all and thought that, you know, the Academy had made some pretty bad choices. But what is interesting as well to me, Josh, is as I went back to the first year where they started nominating more than 5 films, and it was 2009, for the first 2 years of that, 09 and 10, half of the 10 picks for Best Picture were also in my top 10. So I don't know if my tastes have changed a little bit or the Academy's tastes have changed, but there was a lot of overlap there in terms of the movies I thought were among the best that were also getting Best Picture nominations. And now, like I said, 2013, only one. In 2012, only 2. 2011, 3 of the movies were in my top 10 that ended up in the top 9. So that's a lot of rambling and a roundabout way of saying, I think Jeff is mostly right. I didn't look at the Oscar nominations and see anything that completely made me despondent. That said, of course, they're always going to leave out so many great options. That's just the nature of the beast. We do it every week on the show here, right? As we have to whittle our list down to 5 and we leave out some great stuff. The Academy's going to do that too.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I don't worry so much about the films that were nominated, which I didn't really care for, because the Academy is generally looking for very different things in films than I am. So I tend to come away every year with the nominations and just be happy when a film that I really did love did get some honoring, even with a nomination. I'm still glowing from Beasts of the Southern Wild getting that long shot Best Picture nomination last year. Something like that happens, it can carry me through a lot of bad picks.
Yeah, and I guess this year it would be Her for me, my number two film of the year, ending up in that final nine. I think it's safe to say if it was only five nominees, it wouldn't be
probably
among
true.
Those five. But the fact that it did sneak in there and may give other people the opportunity, may prompt people who might have overlooked it to see it, that's a good thing. And that's really the only thing that matters in the grand scheme of all, right? I mean, I don't really care ultimately whether these movies win Oscars or not, but if it does mean they get seen by more people when they're movies like Her that I really do think deserve more recognition, that
there's huge value in that, because these films all get sent back into theaters or expanded into more theaters after getting these nominations. So yeah, that as a platform for giving people a chance to see pictures that might not have otherwise even played in their local multiplex, that's a great thing that the Oscars can do.
Well, a little bit more Best Picture talk here, as we wanted to also share an email that we got in response to our live show and our Golden Brick winner this year. You mentioned The Act of Killing getting a Best Documentary Oscar nomination, and it was our Golden Brick winner, kind of our overlooked movie of the year, the movie we really championed that wasn't seen by many people, made less than $500,000 at the box office, and a lot of Film Spotting listeners saw it and liked it because of us. Keith Geiger from Ocean City, Maryland, longtime listener, is one of those people. He says, I just watched The Act of Killing on Netflix Instant. Wow. Thank you guys again for the show. Great year. Here's an experiment. Take the best movie Oscar winners in the last 5 years and put them against the Golden Brick winners.
This is really interesting. All right, here are the Oscar winners: Slumdog Millionaire, The Hurt Locker, The King's Speech, The Artist, and Argo. Versus the Golden Brick winners: Moon, Dogtooth, The Arbor, Wuthering Heights, and The Act of Killing. Keith says, it's not even close. I'm not sure what this means, and I'm not surprised. I guess it means that you guys champion great movies, and the Academy is a bunch of Philistines.
Yeah, why not? I'll take that lesson if you want to go there. What do you think? If you're being totally honest, you're not siding with Film Spotting, especially since you had
some of
a hand
these picks
in,
were before my
yeah,
time.
You had
yeah.
a hand in two of those choices. Does the Academy win out there or Film Spotting?
Well, at least there is not a film on the Golden Brick
God,
list
here we go.
That I don't care for at all, which would be Argo
yeah.
on the Oscar list. But, you know, really, the King's Speech, I think, is representative, and The Artist as well, of the typical Oscar Best Picture winner in my experience. Movies I was like, eh. Well, okay. I expected it to win. The Hurt Locker, I think, is above that. I really, really like Slumdog Millionaire, so I think that's a good pick. But as a group, no, they don't compare. I mean, Dogtooth, it's not just that these films are doing something unique or interesting or risky. It's that they're doing them so well, and they pull it off.
Yeah, of course, we're going to diverge a little bit here, because for me, Slumdog Millionaire is the only one of the Best Picture nominations that I was middling on. I actually appreciated the other four quite a bit, but I'm with you. I'll take the five Golden Brick winners there any day over those movies. I don't know that our entire audience would agree with that, but thank you, Keith, for giving us another arbitrary battle here on this edition of Film Spotting. And I also want to thank everyone who did come out and everyone who's listened and enjoyed the 2013 Wrap Party from Main Stage last weekend. We were under duress to put that show together. I think, well, maybe that's a little bit of an overstatement, but we were definitely...
I think that's fairly accurate.
We were definitely putting it together at
the
last
minute. We were winging a few things.
We were winging it completely. And you know what? I don't think that really came through. I could be wrong. I'm not objective in this case, but we had fun doing it.
We did.
Michael was great. Of course, Sam, phenomenal. If you're a listener who doesn't listen through the end music and listens to the outtakes that sometimes adorn our shows, you owe it to yourself to go back and hear what started our rap party. Sam's take on James Franco's Alien.
And
that's
without the visuals. So, I mean, Sam has really made a reason well beyond just seeing us two sit up there.
He is the reason.
Looking at
him
each
and
other.
Abraham.
He and Abraham are the reasons you do come and see this live, because...
And Michael Phillips, number
three.
He
has something, Sam has something special for you.
And the top five reasons to see Film Spotting live were maybe four.
I don't think we're on there.
No, I don't know if we make the cut. And of course, great production from Golden Joe Dassault and Tyler Green, who handled everything. They were fantastic. The Main Stage group, everyone there with the crew, did a great job. And it's just a great venue. And the crowd was enjoying the show, it seemed, from our vantage point.
I especially want to thank the person. There may have been two of them who were whistling here and there. I mean, just listening to it afterwards, it really adds another level.
Well, we're going to do, hopefully, a wrap party again next year. We're going to try to make this an annual tradition. We'll see if we get to the third annual one next January. But keep in mind, we've hinted at this a little bit over the past few months. We are anticipating doing a 500th episode live show,
which would be coming up actually fairly soon.
The end of July.
Yeah.
So we'll have a lot more details coming up on this. at filmspotting.net, social media, and of course here on the show over the coming months. But we're excited about it. We've already lined up some special guests. I'll just tease it that way. So if you're someone who's ever thought about coming to a live show, maybe listened and thought that would be fun, the 500th episode might be a pretty good one for you, especially if you're coming from out of town, to just earmark that last weekend in July and think about making the trip. We think it's going to be a good show. So again, our thanks to everyone who made last weekend's wrap party possible. A couple other quick notes I wanted to mention. Bonus content, if you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or the Windows 8 phone, we are going to have some bonus audio this week. We are going to have at least a minute or two on the Wolf of Wall Street ending, and we're going to share some voicemails and a couple of emails on our top 10 films of 2013 list. So look forward to that in the bonus content. All the information you need is available at filmspotting.net. Just click on apps. There's also a link on our website for marathons. And as we're looking ahead to 2014 on this week's show, one of the things hopefully you're looking ahead to is our 2014 marathons. We've already talked about this in some detail. We've listed the films over at Letterboxd as we haven't finalized the exact roster of movies, but we think we have the three topics done anyway.
Yeah, I'm really excited about them too. We're going to hopefully start in February with Satyajit Ray, who made the Apu trilogy, and a handful of other films we might try to include there as well. At least we hope to. We'll see how the schedule breaks down. Then we're going to take a look at some of the films from Elaine May. So this will probably include Ishtar and also an earlier film of hers, A New Leaf. And then this is sort of an embarrassing one, yeah, actually, but I have not seen enough Cassavetes films. I've seen so few that I need a marathon,
yeah,
basically.
I think I've seen two or three, and that's it.
Yeah, me too. So it's time to get to that.
Yeah, and Cassavetes, as longtime listeners know, has been a marathon potential topic and has been even in some poll questions for listeners to vote on going back to when Sam hosted the show. So I believe going back at least to early 2007, we've been kicking around a Cassavetes marathon.
It's time.
It's hard to believe that it's going to take 7 years to finally get to it, but that is our plan. And you got to love Sam. He gave us the Bengali pronunciation of Satyajit Ray.
Is that the wrong?
Yeah, it's
the
Bengali.
I actually found that.
Well, it is.
Is it the wrong one?
Oh, it was you?
It was me.
I just assume it was Sam being all didactic on us. That's the Bengali pronunciation. I think us Westerners can get away with the more traditional Satyajit Ray.
See, now if I had said the traditional, you would have said, now we should actually correct that to the Bengali.
You think I would just do that to disagree with you, Josh?
I have a feeling you would.
Okay, fair enough. Again, if you want to check out that marathons lineup, just go to filmspotting.net and click on marathons.
Time to start looking ahead with our picks for the most anticipated movies of 2014. Just know going in, though, I had Old Boy on my list last year, so I don't know how much you can trust me. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
When I was a child, I believe what they told me.
Every word.
To each one shall come what each one shall earn. If I worked hard, nobody could hold me.
Hold me.
And cheaters will fail, that's what we all learn.
Cheaters never prosper.
Now there is a man who was born with a fortune. A hard day's work he's never done.
Living on Easy Street.
He lives from the sweat of other men's labor.
Thank you time here on the show, Josh. And it's been a little while with the end of the year stuff and the Film Spotting Fix episode and the live show. We haven't had a chance to thank our donors, and there are many of them. So actually, I've had to compress it down a little bit. We're going to have to save some of our recent donations for next week.
Good problem to have.
Yeah, good problem to have. We're going to have to space it out. We do appreciate every single cent that we get and all the kind words we get from our listeners. First, though, I do want to acknowledge our music here. You're hearing Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Couple of the songs in the Method to the Madness here. Goldfinger. Yes, Goldfinger from James Bond. That was their cover. It turns out it's on the soundtrack to The Wolf of Wall Street. And from their new album, which is called Give the People What They Want, you heard the track People Don't Get What They Deserve. And you see what our music consultant slash producer Sam Van Hogen was going for there. Think about the Oscars, some of those people who were snubbed.
I like it.
That's where we were headed. I should have left it out there to see if anyone would actually pick up on that, but I'm guessing not because, well, that's pretty obscure. But we love where Sam's head is at. They're a Brooklyn-based soul group. They start a national tour on February 6th at the Beacon Theater in New York City, and they are coming right here to Chicago, the Vic Theater, on April 11th. So if you're interested in what you're hearing on the show from Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, who I'm pretty sure we've featured before, but again, they have a new album out. Their website is SharonJonesAndTheDapKings.com. Let's get to some of those donations, Josh. We start with a new $10 a month donor, Orowin.
He's very generous Orowin.
Yeah, Centerville, Virginia, new $10 a month donor.
Wow.
Thank you so much for that. Other very generous donors include a couple gold-level donors, Nicholas in Pasco, Washington, and Paul in Portland. Where's he at, Portland? It's not Maine, Josh.
I'm going to say it's probably Oregon.
Oregon. Okay.
Did I do that all right?
He had a few other thoughts for us here.
I first tried to contribute years ago when Sam was the co-host. I wanted a nickname, but I lived in Uganda, my internet connection was crazy slow, and PayPal didn't seem to like East Africa. And I was never able to complete the transaction. Then Sam left, and I had missed my chance at a nickname, so I said heck with it. Finally, many years later, here's something. I love the show. As must be obvious, I've been listening since forever.
So, Paul, I did take the liberty of forwarding your email to Sam Van Hogren, so he could bestow upon you a Sam Van Hogren nickname. And Josh, that nickname is, it's right there. Go ahead and read it.
It is Conscientious Projector.
Very nicely done, man. Sam.
You know what you've started here?
I know.
Sam's going to be getting a lot of requests.
It's what drove donations for a few years here on the show. And you're right. We may get a few more requests for it. And that's fine. I'll pimp Sam out.
Uh-huh.
That's what it takes to get some donations. I may give Sam few cents on the dollar here as those come in. Some new $5 a month donors, and unfortunately a couple here, Josh, the new format with some of the donations that come through from PayPal, I don't have a location. Scott White, Catherine Brannon, also Caesar, I do have a location for him. He's in Chicago. And we got a donation from a company in Lyons, New York called 100 out of 99 Productions.
Nice.
New $5 a month subscribers. Thank you very much. New Silver Club donors, Jonathan in Bloomington, Indiana, and Joseph in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Merry Christmas and sincere appreciation for the free film chatter. I have a busy job and three small kids, so my commute podcast buddies are the closest things I have to a social life these days. I appreciate your work, though I fail to see how you guys, and we just get a comma, an A, and then dot, dot, dot.
Yes.
Must have been interrupted by one of his kids, perhaps.
I guess so. This happens a few times.
That does happen.
Something about that box on PayPal, I don't know, the full note didn't come through, so Joseph and Raleigh, we really want to know what you were going to finish that sentence with. Eliza in New York, also a new Silver Club donor. Delano in New York City as well. Magnus in Oslo, Norway, David in Carmel, California, and Rich in Denton, Texas.
Adam and Josh, second time for my annual donation to the mothership, or should I say my second round to the dealer. Love what you guys do. If only I could wear a t-shirt to show my support to others. Hint, hint, let's get the store stock back. May your 2014 be the best year yet.
So, of course, the store stock is coming back.
Okay.
Because as we've been promoting, we've been giving away some t-shirts recently for Massacre Theater, only we have no t-shirts
right
to give away. But we're close. We're close. We've been working with a new company right here in Chicago. They've recently got the designs figured out. They're our old designs, but we had to do a couple of tweaks to the design and get them ready here for the new company. And we're hoping to launch some new colors, some new styles really soon. So,
sounds very exciting.
Yeah,
we don't have a date on it.
No, we don't have a date exactly yet, but I would say within the next month,
okay,
certainly.
All right.
We'll have that storefront back up if people want to buy a t-shirt or win one playing Massacre Theater. A few other donors we want to thank this week. Brian C. here in Chicago, Glenn in Belmont, Mass., Terrence in Los Angeles, Peter E. in Brooklyn, Joshua in Greenville, South Carolina, Marco, he's in Toronto, Ontario, and Derek P. in Chicago. We're going to go back to Canada, though, for this donation and this note from McGill in Ottawa.
I'm a longtime listener, occasional commenter, and once upon a time Massacre Theater winner. This donation is long, long overdue. As a movie junkie from an early age, it was always my dream to work in the film industry. I first found out about film spotting from a friend in the film department of my university while I was getting my degree. Since then, film spotting's discussions, reviews, and top five lists have been used to calm my nerves on my way to exams, keep me company on long days in the edit suite, and help me stay sharp and engaged at 3 in the morning on arduous film shoots. I may have graduated years ago, but I feel like Film Spotting is a kind of continuing education for me. You guys have put me onto so many great movies, as well as offering interesting analysis and perspective on films, both old and new. You really put the culture in film culture. Keep up the great work.
Thank you very much for that, McGill. We close with this note from Josh Broder in Brooklyn. He says, "Hi, guys. I've been enjoying the show for a couple of years now, tuning in after multiple plugs by Dana Stevens on the Slate Culture Gab Fest podcast. She did me right on that one. Love your show. Recently, I loved contrasting your discussion of Inside Llewyn Davis, which made no mention at all of Bob Dylan, to the Culture Fest discussion, which was all about Dylan's nearly unseen presence." And that is something we didn't talk about Dylan at all, largely because it's something I kind of wanted people to see for themselves without knowing it was coming.
Yeah, I guess it is a little bit of a spoiler.
It's a little bit of one.
Let's not talk about
how it appears.
So let's
not go into any more detail, but that's fascinating. I haven't heard that GabFest, and the fact that they spent so much time on it, it would be an interesting compare and contrast. Josh goes on, "A tribute to that movie's depth, how many places a discussion can go. I'm attaching a link to a movie-related story of mine broadcast this week on the Moth Radio Hour. I had a bit part in The Silence of the Lambs, tiny part, but in a pivotal scene. One person described my story as the ultimate actor's nightmare. Maybe your movie-loving listeners would be interested. Keep up the great work." Haven't had a chance to listen to that yet, but we do have the link, and I'm really curious. So thank you for sending that over, Josh, and thank you for your kind notes about the show. We will link to The Moth and that episode and your story in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. I tried to do right by all of God's children.
Who are you?
I'm Zero, sir. The new lobby boy.
Zero, you say?
Yes, sir.
Well, I've never heard of you, never laid eyes on you. Who hired you?
Mr. Mosher, sir.
Mr. Mosher?
Yes, Monsieur Gustav.
Am I to understand you've surreptitiously hired this young man in the position of a lobby boy?
He's been engaged for a trial period, pending your approval, of course.
Perhaps, yes. Thank you, Mr. Mosher.
You're most welcome, Monsieur Gustav.
You're now going to be officially interviewed.
Should I go and light the candle first, sir?
What? No.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and it's time for the Film Spotting Top 5. Our top 5 most anticipated movies of 2014, you just heard. A little bit more Wes Anderson love. That's the teaser clip from Grand Budapest Hotel, starring Ralph Fiennes as Monsieur Gustave and Tony Revolori there in that scene as Zero. It's a movie that is set to come out in March. And we're going to go ahead and follow the theme of our poll question from last week, the Mr. Anderson death match between Wes Anderson and PTA, and call this top five the Mr. Anderson Memorial List, because you've got two options there in Grand Budapest Hotel and Paul Thomas Anderson's movie Inherent Vice that for me are no-brainer top five picks. If I can only see five movies this year, PTA's movie is number one for me, Inherent Vice.
Budapest would have been on your top five, too?
I think Budapest Hotel might have snuck on to that number five.
Nice.
So either way, to keep the symmetry, I'm going to put it on there. I had three other picks I want to mention here, and I'm just going to mention them here because, again, I want to have our list as usual, Josh. I want us to get into some picks that are maybe not so obvious. They're movies that listeners may need us to help shed some light on and make them aware of so they can look forward to this year. My other picks, along with Grand Budapest and Inherent Vice, fit more into that realm where they're kind of big-name directors, or at least big-name directors to us here on the show. And my number four is one of those guys, Jeff Nichols. His upcoming movie, Midnight Special, it stars Michael Shannon, of course it does, Kirsten Dunst and Joel Edgerton also in the movie. And this one has a little bit of a sci-fi element to it. It's a little bit of a genre film from Jeff Nichols, which we really haven't seen because he's made Shotgun Stories and Take Shelter. And
Take Shelter had sci-fi elements, I would definitely say.
Yeah, you could go that route. It's a little bit of a psychological thriller almost. And then
probably
a movie
more
like
so, yeah.
Mud is one that I think we talked about during our review even. Covers so many different types of genres. A little bit of a fairy tale. It's a coming-of-age movie. It's a domestic drama. There's a lot going on there. And this one, I guess we're going to see that pure genre element in terms of having that sci-fi aspect. So anything Jeff Nichols makes, I'm going to be curious about. Right now, there is not a release date set for Midnight Special, but looking for it as a 2014 release. In October, David Fincher's Gone Girl set to come out, and anything Fincher makes, again, like Paul Thomas Anderson or Wes Anderson, is going to top my list. despite the fact that it stars Ben Affleck, who's not one of my favorite actors. Rosamund Pike also in the movie. That's a thriller adapted from Gillian Flynn's story of the same name. And my number two is Boyhood. Have you been following this at all? I've seen some of the comments
Linklater
on Twitter.
Film, right?
This is
That's
the Linklater
Sundance.
Movie. Yeah, and Richard Linklater, another filmmaker who's gotten a lot of love over the years here on the show. This is a movie that did make its premiere at Sundance, and it's just one of those fascinating experiments where beginning in 2002, Linklater started shooting footage for this movie that ended up being 3 hours long and shot periodically over the past decade to follow these actors and watch them grow in real time, basically. And the fact that it's Linklater is enough for me, but also I love experiments like this, playing with those kind of elements and having characters who we're going to see grow up in front of our eyes. That's something that does appeal to me. So Boyhood there is my number two most anticipated movie of the year, as I mentioned, Inherent Vice from Paul Thomas Anderson, my number one. So those are the obvious top five, Josh, for me.
Okay. Okay. Now I get what you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I want to get to the ones that I guess
your
you could argue.
Top five.
Yeah.
Now we're going to get to your top five.
Which any listener, you could ask longtime Film Spy listener, say, what are the top five movies Adam's most looking forward to? They'd pick those movies, Jeff Nichols, Fincher. They'd talk about Paul Thomas Anderson and Linklater. What are some of the movies that maybe aren't so obvious? And I think you're going to have some picks in here as well that maybe listeners couldn't pinpoint quite that easily. Why don't we get into our list? What's your number five?
Well, in addition to being the Anderson Memorialist, also consider this the take it with a grain of salt list. I mentioned yeah. Old Boy, but I also have to confess that last year at this time, I had The Secret Life of Walter Mitty and Only God Forgives on my
list. Which you didn't like either of those movies.
So it did not work out for me. So anyways, I will plow ahead with my number five and still have high hopes for The Congress, which is a live-action and animated feature, a combo feature from Ari Folman, who's the director of Waltz with Bashir.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, that was a 2008 purely animated documentary, really, which interviewed Israeli soldiers who were part of the 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Really jarring and devastating exploration of the psychological trauma that can be inflicted by warfare. The Congress looks like it's going to be very different subject matter. It centers on an actress, and it's Robin Wright who's playing herself, essentially, and she allows her persona to be digitized. The animation of Waltz with Bashir was so mesmerizing mm-hmm. and hallucinogenic that, you know, I would be willing to follow Folman wherever he wanted to go. But this storyline is also very, very intriguing. There's an odd fact to it as well. I guess it's based on a 1971 sci-fi novel by Stanislaw Lem, who wrote Solaris.
Yeah.
So you've got some sci-fi elements probably coming into play here as well. This is scheduled to play at Austin's Fantastic Fest, which is in September. So I'm not sure of a release date beyond that, but the hope is it'll get some traction there and still be able to make it into theaters and for us to take a look at before the end of the year.
Great pick. It's one that wasn't on my radar at all, so your list has already served a purpose, Josh.
Well,
congratulations.
I'm glad for that.
It's one I'm very excited about. And my number five, I think, is going to springboard off of that very well. If you look at the subject matter, the movie is Ex Machina. And again, release date to be decided at this point, but it stars Domhnall Gleeson, who people would know from the Harry Potter movies, but I believe he was also in Anna Karenina, the Joe Wright movie from last year. And he plays an employee of a big corporation, and the billionaire who runs it picks him to spend a week at his estate and test out a new piece of technology that he's invented. And when he gets there, it turns out that the new piece of technology is a female robot. So makes me think a little bit of Her, mm-hmm. though obviously here we have a body, we have a presence anyway. And the two other actors that are key pieces of why I'm so excited about this story, Oscar Isaac is the billionaire, he of Llewyn Davis, and Alicia Vikander, who was also
right.
in the movie Anna Karenina,
Karenina
I believe
yeah.
the love interest with Domhnall Gleeson. She is that robot figure, and she gave one of my favorite supporting performances of the year in Anna Karenina. So there are some talented actors there. The subject matter intrigues me. Again, makes me think a little bit of Her. But also, you look at the writer and director, you've got Alex Garland making his directing debut. People probably know him most as the collaborator frequently, or at least a couple notable times, with Danny Boyle on 28 Days Later and Sunshine. He also wrote my favorite film of 2008 or 9 or 10 a few years ago, Never Let Me Go. He was the screenwriter of. So take that pedigree. Curious what Alex Garland is going to do from being a screenwriter now to being a director. And with that cast and subject matter, that's one that hopefully we'll get a release date on soon. Ex Machina.
Directorial debut. Okay.
Yep.
Should be interesting. My number four is a little broader of a film. It's The Interview, and it's from Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen, who made their co-directorial debut this year with the apocalypse comedy This Is the End, which made my 2013 top 10. Just really found it funny and sharply satirical. Great gags in there. So I had high hopes for their follow-up as a filmmaking team. The Interview is going to reunite them also with James Franco, who is in This Is the End, but he's not playing himself this time. Here he's a talk show host who gets an interview with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. And then when he gets there, he's recruited by the CIA to assassinate him. Rogan, if Rogan's a plus for you, he's also on screen playing Franco's producer. Now, the last time that a North Korean dictator was part of an irreverent comedy, Team America, World Police.
Oh, really? Okay.
That made top 10 list then, too. So there are chances here that I could really go for The Interview. It does come out October 10. I'm sure they're scheduling that, you know, just in time for the Oscar season.
Yeah, I'm sure. Hey, you never know. And it is one of those movies, I think, like This Is the End, that even if it doesn't completely work for me, which that movie didn't, there's bound to be some hilarious set pieces and hilarious sequences there. So interesting pick. My number four is, I really wanted to look this up today, even though it should be easy. It's Sils Maria, S-I-L-S, another one with A Date to Be Decided. It's the upcoming film from Olivier Assayas, who made Something in the Air, Après-mai, the French title, is a movie that just missed my top 10 of the year. It was in my top 5 of the year so far at the midway point. And like your number 5 pick, it's about an actress. And that actress happens to be one of my favorite actresses ever. Just one of the most interesting faces to look at on screen, as far as I'm concerned, Juliette Binoche. She plays an actress who goes to a village in Switzerland. The movie all takes place there. It happens to be the village where Friedrich Nietzsche resided. I don't know how that's going to play into the larger storyline, but she is there and basically having a little bit of an existential crisis, from what I can tell, really questioning her life and where she's at in her career. And she becomes obsessed with a younger actress. Unfortunately, not a younger actress. I happen to be much of a fan of Chloe Moretz. And she's starring opposite her in a role that originally made the Juliette Binoche character famous. So you know how I am about movies that are about movie making. And I don't know if it's going to be a little bit of a Bergman persona kind of thing where we see them playing off each other. And again, that kind of existential crisis that Binoche character is having. But there isn't anyone I'd more like to watch go through an existential crisis or any kind of crisis on screen than Binoche. Bruno Ganz also stars Daniel Brühl and Brady Corbett. Brühl, people remember, he was in the film Rush this year from Ron Howard that I still haven't caught up with, but I think of him from Inglourious Basterds there as the Nazi hero, the Nazi sniper. So I'm curious about seeing him on screen again, but mainly Binoche and that subject matter. And again, the director. Assayas is a filmmaker. I don't necessarily love every film he's made that I've seen of his, but recently, Something in the Air, Carlos, Summer Hours, these are all breathtaking films that everyone needs to see, and hopefully this one matches up.
Yeah, this will be my chance or my impetus to really catch up with Assayas. I think I've only seen one or two of his films, and I know you're really high on him. What a surprise casting choice with Moretz, though.
I wonder
how that came about. I think it could work. I think I'm a little bit of a bigger fan of hers than you are. My number three is The Lobster, which is going to be the English language debut of Dogtooth director Yorgos Lanthimos. Listen to this setup. I mean, if you know Lanthimos's other films, not only Dogtooth, but also The Alps, it may not surprise you, but this is still weird even for him. It involves forced dating in the future. And supposedly, if you can't find a partner, you're somehow changed into an animal and forced to live in the woods. I think this is how they run things on OkCupid, but I haven't been on there myself, so I can't confirm that.
I don't buy it.
The cast here, though, are really interesting. Ben Whishaw, Jason Clarke, and Lea Seydoux from Blue is the warmest color. And like I said, anything Lanthimos does is going to be of great interest, especially to us here on the show. Dogtooth won the Golden Brick in 2010, and we both liked Alps, his 2012 follow-up. The only catch here is that this is about to begin shooting, so people are talking and hopeful that there'll be a fall or early winter 2014 U.S. release. That would be a real treat if they pull that off.
Well, as it turns out, The Lobster is also my number three most anticipated movie of the year.
Makes
we are
sense.
In agreement about something, but of course, being Lanthimos and his follow-up to Alps and Dogtooth had to be one I strongly consider. That cast really intrigues me as well. Not only you mentioned Seydou and Wishaw and Jason Clarke, but Angeliki Papulia, who was one of the stars of Dogtooth, is back with Lanthimos in this movie. And you're right, just that premise. Talk about your high concepts or whatever the opposite of high concepts are.
Well, it
when
could
you
be
had
like
something like that.
A really broad comedy or a Yorgos Lanthimos film. Those are like your two options that setup.
You don't even have to see the movies. Just read the plot descriptions for Dogtooth, Alps, and The Lobster. And it's almost enough. Just hearing the plot synopses is enough to really make you think about something, even if it's completely absurd. So I do really want to see The Lobster as well and hope it is a 2014 release. What is your number two, Josh?
My number two is The Rover, and this is from Australian director David Michaud, who made Animal Kingdom. That was a 2010 top lister for me, a family crime drama that really turned on a Darwinian sort of ruthlessness. This seems like it could be more familiar genre fare, as that was a little bit. It takes place in the near future, where a loner tracks the gang who stole his car from a desolate town in the Australian outback. Michaud's proven he can make this stuff feel intensely fresh, even though it may be familiar material, so open to whatever story he does decide to tackle. Cast includes a few promising names. Guy Pearce will be in this, along with Robert Pattinson. That's an odd but enticing combination.
Fantastic in Cosmopolis.
Say. Yeah, we both really appreciate his work in Cosmopolis, so I think there's definitely potential there. The American distributor is A24, and they have it listed on their site as a 2014 release date. They just haven't set a specific date yet.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam. We're sharing our top five most anticipated movies of 2014, and another one I wasn't familiar with there, The Rover, Josh, but David Michaud, you mentioned Animal Kingdom, really interesting movie. And he is one of those filmmakers I'm going to be keeping an eye on. So I'm curious about The Rover as well. My number two, I'm going to go with a comedy and one that actually, as of right now, has a release date. And that's May 16th. It's The Trip to Italy, the follow-up from Michael Winterbottom to The Trip from a few years ago. I think it's 2011. And this reunites the team of Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. And The Trip was really them, I believe. They somehow got an assignment. It's been a while since I've seen it, where they were going to go tour some restaurants and do some kind of feature on restaurants in the English countryside. But it becomes this story really about where they're at in their careers, where they're at in their marriages and their personal life, their relationship with each other. It becomes really about masculinity in a lot of ways. And of course, it also becomes about impressions. And there are a lot of great scenes in that movie where you just have those two great impressionists, Coogan and Brydon, playing off each other to great effect. That scene, much talked about on the show when it came out, where they do their Michael Caine impressions and Anthony Hopkins and Richard Gere.
Richard Gere does a very interesting technique. He does in a lot of his films. A lot of people pick him up on it. What he does, he'll listen to what someone says, and then he'll smile enigmatically. Then he'll look away into the middle distance as if remembering something from the past, laugh about it, then return to the dialogue. So he'll go,
let me say something, you respond that way.
Okay, go on.
Okay. Malcolm. He'd never play a character called Malcolm.
No, he wouldn't. Joshua.
Joshua.
It's a costume drama. Continue.
Joshua, folk in the village are saying you're never going to come back.
Pa, I...
Whoa, I'm not your bloody father.
The funniest thing I saw in any movie all year for me. So those two guys together, and similar subject matter here, The Trip to Italy, they get another assignment. They are going on a culinary trip, and they're retracing the steps of some romantic poets as they toured Italy. And I think it's probably going to cover pretty similar ground, obviously, with these characters. And that's fine with me. I will go on a trip with these two characters anywhere they want to go. It could be the trip to Berwyn, Josh. I'll go
right
down the road with them because I just find them fascinating. And Coogan is one of those guys who, as we said, we touched on Philomena a little bit and how that movie got an Oscar nomination. Neither of us think it's one of the best nine movies of the year. But one of the reasons it's pretty good, or at least okay and certainly watchable, is because of Coogan.
Mm-hmm.
And he co-wrote it, but also because of his performance. And I mentioned him on our live show, too, as one of my good performances in a bad movie, The Look of Love, another movie with Michael Winterbottom from this year. Steve Coogan just has talent. whether it's as a comedic actor or a dramatic actor, I think we always see something new, some new element to his character, his persona on screen in every role he takes. And I don't think he's a guy that you can pigeonhole. You want to pigeonhole him as an impressionist or as just a comedic actor. Somebody
yeah, he's
who
way past
works
that
with
now.
Winterbottom. No,
yeah.
He can do anything.
Definitely.
And he's always interesting on screen. So the trip to Italy for me, May 16th, can't wait.
Yeah, and my response to that is probably similar to the one you had with the interview. Even if the whole thing doesn't all come together or is consistently hilarious, there are going to be some priceless scenes, without a doubt. My number one is an instance, you know, I love it when big time cinematic visionaries tackle big subjects. And that's what we're going to get with
Interstellar.
You're
going Aronofsky.
No,
oh,
not
no.
Aronofsky. No.
I thought you might
Noah.
Go Noah.
No. No. I've seen the trailer, Adam. I know you avoid them, but
I do.
You should especially avoid this one. Interstellar, though, this is from Christopher Nolan. And I think he's the sort of guy you want Hollywood giving all their money to. And that doesn't happen all the time. A lot of times, the people who get the most money from Hollywood don't do the best work with it. Nolan, I'd say, has in the past. And so in this instance, it could be another something on the level of Inception, which I know it's faded a little bit in some people's minds, but I still hold up as a really fascinating puzzle piece of a big movie with a big budget. Interstellar has something to do. All we know is it has something to do with space exploration and wormholes. It seems like it's pretty much under wraps, even though there's a teaser trailer out for that as well. But like Inception, what also really attracts me to this film is the fact that it's another original idea. This is written with Christopher Nolan's brother, Jonathan, and it's not another sequel. It's not a superhero story, even though he's done those. It's not anything that's jumping off of other things we've seen before directly. Obviously, it's going to be referencing things like 2001 and other big movies by big visionaries, but it's still going to have its own original nugget. The cast has Matthew McConaughey, my man who can do no wrong. Also has Anne Hathaway, Jessica Chastain, Casey Affleck, and of course the Nolan-required Michael Caine. And if you're still not interested, Adam, I have one more element which might push you towards really wanting to see this. I know you like Nolan, but still, the cinematography is by Hoyt Van Hoytema of Spike Jonze's Her.
That's right.
Yeah.
One of my favorite pieces of cinematography this year.
There you go. That's coming out November 7, Interstellar, so can't wait for that.
Did strongly consider that for my obvious list of top fives,
because
you talk about Paul Thomas Anderson and Fincher and some of those filmmakers, Linklater, Nolan's in there, and I'm not degrading your pick in any way. I'm surprised actually to see it a little bit at your number one. I didn't realize you were quite such the Nolan fan, but I can't argue with the choice at all. And I'm going to go from Christopher Nolan to Ned Benson.
Oh, Ned Benson. Also a visionary?
I don't know. We'll find out. With my number one, another one that doesn't have a release date. I think it played at the Toronto Film Festival this past September. So some people listening may have already had the chance to see this film. It's his debut film, so that's why we haven't heard of Ned Benson quite yet. I'm going to give you its 2 stars. And from what I can tell of the premise here, it's going to feature them really prominently in the movie. James McAvoy. Any takers? I love James McAvoy. Mm-hmm. I also love Jessica Chastain, who stars in your number one there. And they play a couple who's been together, I think it's for 7 years. She decides to leave him. And really, the setup here, the concept here is simply that we get him and her. We get 2 separate sides to the movie. We get both perspectives on the breakup and the aftermath. Both, if I'm reading this right, are 90-minute films. And it's not clear yet whether or not you're going to see them as a single package or separately. But there are 2 90-minute movies. One focuses on James McAvoy's perspective of the breakup, the other focusing on Chastain. I love those performers. I'm a sucker, I guess, for this type of experiment.
It's the structure thing.
It's
that's
the structure.
Got you hooked.
I am really hooked, I have to say. There's something about that. I'm always fascinated by perspective on screen and seeing things from a different angle and how the subjective take on that influences and your own biases and prejudices influence the way you perceive a certain situation. It's something that has come up a lot in certain film discussions over the years. Even in a movie like 500 Days of Summer, I recall, there's a scene there. I didn't love that movie, but I loved a certain scene where we get the perspective once in the record store from Joseph Gordon-Levitt's take, and then we get the take on it from Zooey Deschanel's, and it's completely different. But I think in a really believable, authentic way that is probably how couples perceive things differently every day. And if that concept can play out over the course of 2 90-minute films, I guess we'll see. I'm certainly intrigued enough to be very, very excited about seeing it. Again, we'll see if we can get some more information on the release date as time goes on here. But the movie is called The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. those are our top five or so most anticipated movies of 2014. Josh, I'd ask you for your honorable mentions, but I'm going to start with an accusation of sorts. How does a Josh Larson most anticipated list not include Tim Burton?
Big Eyes.
Big Eyes. How's that not
honorable
your
mention?
One?
Well, you know, these just sound more intriguing. And Burton, I'm still really interested in what he does, but he's just no longer a top-of-the-line filmmaker based on some of his recent projects. Now, Frankenweenie, I'd put up there with some of his best work, but that's also hearkening back to his earlier work. Mm-hmm. So in terms of what he's going to do now, completely new, yeah, I want to see it, but this other stuff just intrigues me more. Definitely an honorable mention, though. And I'll mention some other favorite directors of mine, which I would still consider him to be, who do have things coming out. The Dardenne brothers have 2 days, one night. Wim Wenders has Everything Will Be Fine. Mm-hmm. Lynn Shelton, I know you really like, Adam. Her new film is Laggies. David Cronenberg's going to give us Maps to the Stars in 2014. And then Terry Gilliam, well, you never know if his films are actually going to come out, but supposedly in 2014, we'll get Zero Theorem. And then I also want to second one of your obvious choices, certainly is Jeff Nichols' Midnight Special, probably my number six.
Yeah, we've mentioned a lot of these guys already, whether in our picks or our obvious picks or your honorable mentions, but I just want to list here quickly the list of big directors. I'm just going to call them big for lack of a more appropriate phrase. Prominent filmmakers who have movies coming out in 2014, and what made these lists so hard to put together. We mentioned Paul Thomas Anderson, Wes Anderson, David Fincher, Richard Linklater, Jeff Nichols, Darren Aronofsky and Noah, Tim Burton and Big Eyes, Christopher Nolan and Interstellar, Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu, a filmmaker I am not a fan of at all, and I don't think he has a comedic bone in his body, making a comedy called Birdman.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd put him on this list.
No,
either,
not though. Quite up yeah. there with some of those filmmakers, but Todd Haynes has a movie coming out called Carol, Nymphomaniac from Lars von Trier, The Dardennes, who you mentioned, 2 Days, One Night, Cronenberg, Mike Lee has a new movie coming out, as well as David Gordon Green, who made Prince Avalanche this past year that we really enjoyed. So, a lot of very well-regarded filmmakers.
We got a
with
lot
new
of,
movies coming out.
We got a lot of watching.
It's going to be a busy year. And I didn't even mention someone you did, Wim Wenders. Everything Will Be Fine. It's in 3D. Wim Wenders, they're making a 3D. Was
as his last film was.
Yeah,
yes.
Which I also like that movie quite a bit. James Franco, Sarah Pauly, Charlotte Gainsbourg in that film. Put those three together with Wim Wenders. It's obviously going to be one I want to see. And we didn't mention How to Catch a Monster, written and directed by my guy, Ryan Gosling.
I saw that.
Yeah, Ryan Gosling. Saoirse Ronan's also in it, Eva Mendes, and Ben Mendelsohn, my scene stealer of the year on that one. And the cinematographer on How to Catch a Monster is Benoit Deby. I hope I'm saying that right. He's the cinematographer who shot Spring Breakers. I loved his work on that film. So curious to see what he and Ryan Gosling will come up with for that movie. We want to know your picks or any other comments about the show. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744.
Do you think we've left any titles off that they can come up with? We seem to have covered.
We'll try to list all of these at our website,
yeah.
filmspotting.net. Click on top fives if you want to review the list.
Don't forget, you can also find us on Twitter. We're at filmspotting, and we're at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Going to rush through these here real quick. Some new releases in wide release. Gimme Shelter, starring Vanessa Hudgens. I, Frankenstein, Aaron Eckhart in that Mary Shelley inspired, adapted. I don't know. Do you know anything about it?
You got to stop me from going to see this because
really?
Part of me wants to, and I know I shouldn't. It's just the Frankenstein thing.
Yeah, I hear you. Out in limited release opening this weekend in Chicago, Generation War, a 3-part German miniseries about World War II. Gloria, a drama from Chile. The Invisible Woman, directed by and starring Ralph Fiennes as Charles Dickens. Maiden Trip, this is a movie that our friend David Ehrlich from Film.com describes this way. Imagine if Life of Pi was a really great documentary about Jennifer Lawrence and the tiger was puberty.
Okay.
I'm sold. I am
Got
sold.
It.
That's all I need to hear about that movie. Also out, The Broken Circle Breakdown, an Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Language Film from Belgium. Again, David Ehrlich says it's an absurdly potent folk drama, and it's a movie he mostly liked. And Josh, we are at this point, as we look ahead to next week's show, planning on discussing Broken Circle Breakdown.
Yeah, I think we should do that.
Yeah.
People have a chance to see it. It's got attention from the Oscar mm-hmm. nomination.
Though tough to overlook The Pass, the new
right.
film from Asghar Farhadi, which is also out here in Chicago and in select theaters around the country. So we're still discussing it a little bit, but right now it looks like Broken Circle Breakdown. We also may spend a few minutes on Life Itself, the new documentary from Steve James, who made this film about Roger Ebert, adapted from Ebert's memoir of the same name. We'll also continue our preview of 2014. This is something we started last year. We've shared the films, and 57 or 100 or so directors' names to think about. What about the performers? And a few of them you heard in there in those lists, but what about the performances in particular that we're really excited about from 2014? We'll share those next week on the show.
You know what? There are actually a few movies that haven't been mentioned in this show that I'm considering
I
for
don't
that
believe
list.
It. I don't believe
there
it.
Really are, including one big director. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music comes from Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. More information is at, yes, you guessed it, SharonJonesandTheDapKings.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.